Coming here this evening for a very special event, an international guest. My name is Peter Pomerantsev. I work here at the Institute for Global Affairs, where I run a little project which tries to deconstruct today's propaganda conflicts. Our guest today is Marcy Shaw, who teaches history at Yale and is the author of really many important books about Eastern Europe, Central Europe, about dissidents, about what freedom means. But her new book is called The Ukrainian Night, An Intimate History of the Revolution. And it's an absolutely unique book, which I've had the honor to review. It's so different to all the many, many political economy, current affairs, political science-y sort of looks at what happened on the Maidan and in the war that's still going on afterwards, which really looks at it from the point of view of the human experience and does something quite unique. It tries to sort of almost construct a sort of a spiritual journey that a revolutionary actor goes through and the changes of their experience and how their subjectivity and selfhood changes in that process. It really is so strikingly different to all the other stuff out there that I can't recommend it enough. Our other guests and also really the co-organizer of today, so not really a guest, more a host, is Marina Pezenti, who many of you will know as the director of the Ukrainian Institute, which has really become a vital place to discuss Ukraine, which has become a vital country. So the format for this evening, Marcy's going to introduce the book and some of the core ideas. Marina's going to talk a little bit about the current affairs context of the revolution and what's happening in Ukraine now. Then we're going to have a really, really fascinating discussion, and then you're going to join us. So, Marcy, take it away.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you to Marina, and thank you for Peter, for being here with me and for inviting me. It's lovely to be here. I come to London relatively rarely, but it's lovely to be here. So I'll tell you a little bit about the book, and then everyone can pick up on what topics are of interest to them. And as Peter already said, I'm not a political scientist, so this book is not really about political analysis. It was moreover a book I never intended to write. You know, in fact, in general, it was the kind of book I very specifically intended not to write, because one of the differences between historians and political scientists is that, one, historians are under no pressure to write in real time. And in fact, the big advantage that historians have over journalists and political scientists is precisely that we do not write in real time. Hegel, I think, was wrong about many things. But one thing he basically had right, you know, was his, you know, big idea of the owl of Minerva that spreads her wings only with the falling of the dusk. That is, only when everything's over can you look back and figure out what it was all about. It's very difficult to figure out what things mean in real time. So the big advantages that historians have over journalists and social scientists is that, looking back, you can know more than any individual person could know in real time, both because you know the consequences of what happened, you know, and because given enough time and enough diligence, you can gather many more sources than any single person could have in real time. These are the epistemological advantages of retrospect. So I was very determined, and I've long been very determined, not to write about things as they happen. And so let me maybe tell you first, and that will give you a sense of what the book is about, why I broke my own rule about not writing about things in real time. And that has to do with the fact that of the quarter century or so, I've been an American hanging out in Eastern Europe, which is now my whole adult life. This was the most extraordinary thing I had ever seen. The Maidan was the most extraordinary thing I had ever seen watching in real time. You know, all these years I've been coming to Eastern Europe as a student of history, as a graduate student, as a historian. I had learned a lot and heard a lot about extraordinary things that happened before I got there. And I had known a lot of people who had experienced extraordinary things, you know, sometimes in a good sense, most often in a catastrophic sense. But that was always before I had met them. They were always stories from the past. And the Maidan was the most amazing thing that I saw happen, kind of in my time, in front of my eyes. You know, and given that it happened after I had already been hanging around in Eastern Europe 20-some years, I had a sense of just how remarkable that was, that I was seeing something very, very special. And I was, you know, as you know, I was an American at the time. I was in Vienna at a very special place. I won't tell you the whole story about it, but it's the Institute for Human Sciences, which was originally created as, to a large extent, a meeting place for East European and Western European intellectuals, still during the Cold War in Vienna. And in Vienna during that year, I had a lot of Ukrainian colleagues who were coming back and forth between Vienna and Kiev. You know, and in some sense, it was largely through their eyes, you know, and through the drama of their transformations that I originally kind of found myself being pulled in. So I was an American in Vienna, and the proximity of being closer to Kiev than I would have been in Connecticut was important. I was also, to a certain extent, seeing the Maidan largely through Polish eyes. As I was reading in English and German and Russian and Czech, although it was not so useful at the time, but in some ways it was the Polish coverage that ended up being decisive for me. And what I was doing in Vienna, what I was supposed to be doing in Vienna, was writing a book about philosophy in Eastern Europe and looking at a specific philosophical tradition, phenomenology turned existentialism, which I won't bore you all with at the moment, although I, of course, think it's quite fascinating, but looking at how this particular philosophical tradition eventually leads us after 1968 in the death of faith in Marxism through the 70s and 80s into a philosophy of dissent, a philosophy of resistance, and a philosophy of opposition. And that's something I'd been interested in a long time. How I came to Eastern Europe was having been at a very impressionable age in 1989. I was 17. And being very wrapped up in the romance of those Velvet Revolutions. And when I had just turned 18, that was the moment in February 1990 that Václav Havel, as the first post-communist president of Czechoslovakia, came to Washington and gave his first speech before a joint session of the American Congress. And for those of you who don't remember, I'll remind you what he said there was, "Consciousness precedes being, and not the other way around, as the Marxists claim." I suspect probably nobody in the Congress knew what it meant. I mean, the chances that very many of them remembered those passages in German ideology where Marx and Engels explain that being precedes consciousness, and so one sense of self and thinking is merely derivative of their objective material position in the socioeconomic order. Probably nobody got that. But it sounded very beautiful, even though nobody knew what that meant. And one of the journalists there said, "Wow, if I could talk like that, I would run for God." I didn't know what it meant at the time either, but I thought it sounded very, very beautiful. And in some sense, some couple decades later, the book that I was supposed to be writing when I got distracted by the Maidan, and I'm now writing, was about that philosophical tradition. What does it mean that consciousness precedes being? What does it mean that the human subject, that selfhood, you know, that the way we understand ourselves and our moral responsibility in the world is prior to and transcendent of any kind of socioeconomic political constraints. And that was the tradition that originally led me to Eastern Europe, and that was a tradition that had in some sense largely gotten lost, which Václav Havel was bemoaning to the day he died, which, you know, Adam Michnik continues to kind of lament. And right before the Maidan, the Polish philosopher and former Solidarity activist Marcin Krul, you know, wrote a book basically saying we were stupid, we failed, you know, we didn't win in 1989 the way we thought we did, and a journalist said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, we're now experiencing a non-trivial economic crisis, a serious political crisis, and perhaps a fatal spiritual crisis. And the journalist says, well, what's the fatal spiritual crisis? And Marcin said, well, we've stopped asking ourselves questions. And the journalist said, well, what kind of questions? And Marcin said, well, metaphysical questions. We've stopped asking ourselves, for instance, where does evil come from? And this was the tradition that had long interested me, that I had learned about as history, that I had researched for years. And suddenly the Maidan happened, and I realized that this wasn't just the next political protest, this was the return of metaphysics. You know, this was the realization of the human stakes of all of these philosophical ideas I had been interested in. And it was impossible to turn away from that. You know, that remains one of the most compelling experiences of my life. And one of the things that the book is about, really, it's not about politics, but it is about the experience of revolution. And it's about the relationship between the human subject, between the self, between selfhood and revolution. And one of, if not, you know, the key idea that Adam Michnik introduced in Poland in the 1970s, which became central to solidarity in Poland, was the word podmiotowość in Polish, which is subjectivity, which became at that time a revolutionary word. What does it mean to be a human subject? It means you live, Adam says, as if you were free. That means you live as if you were a free person, bearing moral responsibility for all of your actions and decisions, regardless of any kind of social limitations or political limitations or constraints. And the Maidan happened, and I was talking to Polish friends, and one of them said to me, like, wow, Marcy, subjectivity. I haven't heard that word since the days of Solidarity. And that's what I couldn't turn away from. And in some sense, the book is about that. You know, the book is about what subjectivity means, you know, and what we learn about the self from watching the Maidan. So let me, I'll just make a couple quick observations. I don't want to babble too long because I have two very interesting interlocutors. I had no idea in November 2013 that anything very dramatic was going to happen. I was not following contemporary Ukrainian politics or really contemporary any politics very closely, you know, at the time. I mean, I understood it was a disappointment when Yanukovych failed to sign the association agreement. I didn't get the sense that anybody was willing to die over it. And I don't think people were in November 2013. And one of the things the book looks at is, in November 2013, nobody was willing to die. By late January, a critical mass of people were willing to die there. And you felt that. I mean, even watching it live stream from Vienna, it was almost palpable. And you felt that in February. You felt that onslaught, and you realized that those people were not going to leave, that a decision had come down, and really that kind of strongest existentialist sense of making a decision that defines who you are. And there was a critical mass of people, and they were willing to die. And how did that happen? What made that existential transformation happen? And as a historian, then, there were certain things that just kind of captivated me as details, like that little Facebook post that Mustafa Nayyem, you know, writes in Russian, his, you know, hey, if you guys are really upset, you know, come out to the Maidan by midnight tonight. Likes не считаются. Likes do not count. Interestingly, like, I don't know what Peter thinks about this, but that, for some reason, that sentence often got mistranslated into English, like, don't just like this post. And it's one of these rare serendipitous moments when the Russian actually translates perfectly into English. I mean, it's literally, likes do not count. And I thought that was remarkable because that's a sentence that would have meant nothing before Facebook. It would have had no meaning. I mean, it's a sentence you couldn't throw it out there 15 years ago. It would be utterly devoid of meaning. And now it's going to become a revolutionary slogan for the 21st century. And one of the things I probe in the book is precisely this, the relationship between social media and transparency and subjectivity. The second moment that as a historian I found irresistible, and I'll try to explain why, is that One of the things I've long been interested in, and not just me, but many historians, is how generational identity fuels historical change. The age at which you are at certain moments. You know, historians look at things through all kinds of lenses. You can look at things through religious identity, through linguistic identity, through ethnic identity, through racial identity, but you can also look at generational identity. You know, and you could theoretically implot the whole history of Marxism and communism as a series of Oedipal revolts. Each generation rising up against the fathers, you know, in its turn. Many revolutions, in fact, the trope of revolution is the trope of Oedipal revolt. You know, the sons rise up against the fathers. You know, so in the beginning, you're watching, and there are these students, and they're protesting, and students are supposed to protest. When they don't protest, and in Poland, it hasn't been the young people, it's been the older people, which is making everybody very worried. But that's what you're supposed to do when you're a student. You're supposed to be out there on the streets. I tell this to my students all the time. In fact, I tell this to my kids, too, who like know they're supposed to be out there in the streets, even though they're only 6 and 8. But they spend quite a bit of time out there on the streets. You know, so you have students that are out there on the streets. I might have all fizzled away had not Yanukovych decided to bring out his thugs, you know, to brutally beat them up on November 30th. I mean, I have no privileged epistemological access to what was going on inside Yanukovych's head, but presumably he's then counting on the fact that you scare people that way, you brutalize the students, and now the parents are going to pull their kids off the streets, which seemed to me a reasonable expectation, not in the normative sense, but, you know, in the, like, yes, likely the parents will pull their kids off the streets. And that's when, as a historian, this was a miraculous moment, because November 30th comes and the parents do not pull their kids off the street. They join them there. That's extraordinary from a historian's perspective, when the parents join their kids off the streets. I mean, there were a few hundred, several hundred people there. I mean, you know, 24, 48 hours later, you have close to 1 million people on the streets of Kiev. No one has ever seen that many people on the streets of Kiev. You know, one of the kids I talked to, I mean, literally kids, like, he was 16, living with his mother. He wasn't even at university yet, who was one of the students who gets beaten up by Berkut that night on November 30th. And when I talked to him later in Kiev, I said, you know, your mother must have been very upset. You know, you're like, but she let you go back. And he said, my mother was making Molotov cocktails on Hrushevskaya Street. And that's something very special. And that changes also the character of what's happening. Because I think what Vasil Cherepanim's comment that Euromaidan, you know, lasted through November. And after November 1st, it was just Maidan. And it was no longer just about an association agreement. An association agreement that, with the EU, that understandably had much higher stakes for younger people than for older people. You know, if you were a student, it meant, was Europe going to be open to you? It meant, were you going to be able to go on Erasmus exchanges? Were you going to be able to get internships? Were you going to be able to learn foreign languages? Was the world going to be open to you? It meant the most to you if you were a student. After November 30th, it meant that, but much, much more. And I think what Europe meant was much more. I think in November, the Europe that was at stake on the Maidan was the literal empirical, you know, European Union. Were we going to be able to get in without having to humiliate ourselves and spend years waiting in line and pleading for visas? You know, was that Europe going to be open to us? I think by December, that Europe that was at stake, you know, what was a kind of platonic essence of Europe-ness. It was Europe in the sense that Western civilization was, when somebody famously asked Gandhi what he thought of Western civilization, and he says, it would be a very good thing. That was that Europe that was going to be human dignity, that was going to be the rule of law, that was going to be the antithesis of what in Russian you call proizvol, which is one of these words we're learning all too much about in the States at the moment. It's a word we don't have in English. The sense of arbitrariness tinged with tyranny. And what it really is being treated as an object and not as a subject. You know, in the Kantian sense, it means being treated as an instrument, as a means, and not as an ends, of not being treated as a full person. You know, Proizvol was, you are a plaything, and the powers that be can do whatever they want to you capriciously. And Europe was the antithesis of that. Europe was no longer the empirical, tangible, highly imperfect instantiation of Europe. Europe was going to be human dignity and the rule of law and human rights. It was going to mean being treated as a subject and not an object. You know, the Maidan became more than just protesting the government. It became a parallel polis. You know, where kind of in the spirit that Adam Michnik meant, you live as if you were free. You know, you create the world you want to live in. You know, and suddenly you have food distribution and clothing distribution and people volunteering all sorts of talents, and you have an open university and you have film screenings and you have medical points and you have people creating the world as they want it to be, living as if they were free. So one of the things the book looks at is the Maidan as a parallel polis, you know, as self-organization, as a kind of masterful feat of self-organization, as a kind of revelation of the potential for self-organization. It looks at the existential dynamics of making a decision. I was struck by how often my Ukrainian friends and colleagues started using this phrase in different languages, and then I made a choice. And then I made a decision. And then I made this choice. I was struck by how the experience of time changed on the Maidan. You know, suddenly people started saying, well, and then I lost track of time. Or something strange happened to time. Or was that yesterday? Was it last week? And then suddenly there was no more difference between night and day. You could call anyone at any time of day, and that held true whether you were 18 or whether you were 75. Those boundaries became blurry. You were afraid of falling asleep. Well, why are you afraid of falling asleep? Because you can wake up an hour later to discover that everything, absolutely everything, has changed. In some sense, it's the principle of revolution, that at every given moment, everything can be completely different from the state of affairs and rules obtaining 5 minutes earlier. And maybe the last thing I'll say about that is that one of the things I had been interested in as kind of a historian of philosophy to some extent is precisely the meaning of time, this experience of kind of temporality. What does the present mean? You know, and the present has really been a challenge for philosophers, because what is the present? You can't, like, it has no duration. You can't grasp it. As soon as you try to kind of grasp it, it's already gone. My brother-in-law is a plasma physicist, and he said, well, you know, Marcy, it's, I mean, we have a concept, T equals zero, you know, time is zero, that's the present, but it's purely theoretical. It really doesn't exist. And the present doesn't exist. It really, like, it's an imperceptible punctuality. It's always either before or after. And Sartre's idea, I made all my students, you know, right after the Maidan, read a lot of philosophy of temporality as I was trying to understand what was happening. And Sartre's idea of the present, then, he says, well, what the present is the present is a border. It's a border between the realm of facticity, what has already happened and cannot be changed, who you have been, what you have done, you know, what has happened until now. And the realm of transcendence, which is the possibility to go beyond what has happened or who you have been until now. And that moment when you cross from what Sartre calls the en soi, or the in itself, to the pour soi, the for itself, the moment when you cross from what cannot be changed to the possibility of going beyond, that is the present. And the Maidan for me was a kind of illumination of that ideally is what revolution does. It cast a kind of glaring light on that moment that is always with us, but we normally don't notice it. When we cross from what has been and can no longer be changed into that possibility of going beyond what has been and beyond who we have been until now. And even if that is a kind of imperceptible moment or imperceptible illumination that flickers for a moment and then is gone, it's a revolution. Revolution is a revelation of the human capacity to go beyond. And that's what I try to capture in that book.
However, all these illuminations happen in do happen in a real world of current events. So, Marina, why don't you take us into that into that space?
So back to Earth a little bit. Well, thank you very much, Rossi, for bringing up your memories of learning Marxist philosophy. I'm trying to remember when I entered university in 1989 in Kiev, which was still Soviet Union times, and we learned Marxist-Leninism as part of our curriculum, and I remember, you know, learning this about being preceding consciousness and vice versa. And I remember that our professor, literally a couple of years down the line when Soviet Union collapsed, he had to teach us Ukrainian history because Marxist-Leninism was no longer part of the curriculum. So that was also that moment of, you know, dramatic transformation that we had to go through. I just came back from Ukraine and I had a couple of meetings with lots of interesting people. Actually, one of them is a character in your book. It's Yaroslav Gritsak, who is a professor of the Ukrainian Catholic University. And the other one is Yevhen Lyubovitsky, who is a strategist and a thinker. And Peter knows him very well. He spoke in London on many occasions. So on that subject of solidarity, yes? Why all of a sudden Ukrainians transcended all these differences between, generations and their social backgrounds, etc. Looking at this as one of these, interlocutors that I met in Ukraine, Yevhen Lyubovitsky pointed out that looking at this from the historic point of view, it's actually quite extraordinary because if you look at the Ukrainian history for the last 100 years, you see a sequence of, let's say, civil war of 19, following the Bolshevik Revolution, and Ukraine was right at the epicenter of it. And then you have Great Famine, and then you have Stalinist purges, and then you have 4 years of German occupation, and then you have several decades of very tight grip of the Soviet regime, and you have Chernobyl nuclear disaster, and the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the economic turmoil that followed, the rise of the oligarchy and the Orange Revolution of 2004 and deceived expectations, and then you have Maidan and the war in Donbas and the annexation of Crimea. So you have a sequence of very turbulent and often very tragic events which actually result in a huge sense of insecurity that most Ukrainians actually have experienced in decades. That resulted in a very low kind of planning horizon for most Ukrainians, and the main focus in terms of kind of the set of values and motivations that they pursue in their lives, the main motivation is survival, actually. While for most people in developed countries, it is about self-realization and self-fulfillment. And all of a sudden, Maidan changes that. So, you know, we actually feel on Maidan, we feel safer than anywhere else. All this sense of insecurity is gone, quite the opposite, you know. Furthermore, not only that Ukrainians feel safe there, not only that they feel a sense of self-fulfillment of doing something for the success of Maidan, you know, like lots of middle-class Ukrainians from all over the country came to Maidan, they felt they had to be there, but even more so, some of them felt that they could sacrifice their lives, which is quite extraordinary. And I actually still struggle to find an explanation why, given, you know, the historic background that Ukrainians have, they actually managed to pull off something like that. So looking at how things stand now, so there's been lots of talk about if the glass is half empty or half full, have Ukrainian reforms actually succeeded or not. I tend to believe that, obviously, you can criticize Ukraine for not fighting corruption, and there's lots been spoken about it, especially on a very high level, and despite the fact that Ukraine managed to set up special bodies to do that, like anti-corruption prosecutor's office and anti-corruption courts. But despite that, Ukraine has managed to introduce some remarkable things. And then again, the revolution is over and you have to get down to a very hard job of actually doing reforms and incrementing, very small changes step by step. Just one simple fact. Ukraine stopped completely its dependence on Russian gas. Yeah, it's a very mundane fact. But I remember when I worked for BBC Ukrainian service, for many years, this was like, you know, the news that we had to report about all the time. You know, Ukraine and Russia concluding, signing yet another gas agreement. Russia accusing Ukraine of stealing gas. You know, Russian gas not being delivered to European customers. Shady intermediary, you know, standing in the way, etc., etc. All of a sudden, this whole kind of information paradigm has been taken away. And why is it important? Yes, you could say it's a very technical thing, but it's important as part of a narrative, again, that, you know, previously when Ukraine so much depended on Russian gas, you could say it's a failed state, it's not reliable, you know, Europe cannot really count on Ukraine. All of a sudden, all of that is gone. Mm. Similarly, when you look at the reunification of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which is now probably looks imminent, once again, it's a huge informational breakthrough for Ukraine because you undermine that underlying narrative, you know, about Ukrainian Russians and Belarusians being one single people with its origins in Kievan Rus and baptism by Prince Volodymyr, etc. So that's an incredible turnaround. But now, so should we actually expect that there should be a dramatic overhaul just in the space of 5 years in Ukraine? When you look at other countries in this region, which actually acceded to EU, like Poland, Hungary, and Czech Republic, what is happening to those countries now? We see a rise of nationalism. We see, you know, the system of checks and balances is being challenged. There's onslaught on free media. Judicial system is being undermined. So should we conclude that their transition to this free Western democratic world has happened too quickly, possibly? Maybe Ukraine is actually choosing the right way by doing things incrementally and slower. Look at what's happening in Georgia. I went to Georgia just a month ago, and it's a huge difference to what it was under Saakashvili times, so there's a rollback. So it's more about actually sustainability and moving step by step, but it's probably yet to be seen how it's going to succeed in Ukraine. And one should not assume that actually the reforms are fizzing out in Ukraine. In some of the areas, for example, healthcare and education, and this is hugely underreported in the West, the battle is still rages on, actually, full on, between the old guard and the new civic activists trying to push for change. And for example, the reform of the cultural sector has only just started, and it's very fascinating to watch for me as director of Ukrainian Institute and being in touch with some of the key players. Finally, a few words about new emerging identity. I would agree with Yaroslav Hrtsak on this, that the main achievement of Maidan that Ukraine has finally cut the umbilical cord with Russia. So it's no longer part of the Russian sphere of influence. And with every passing day of the conflict in Donbas, it becomes clear that there's no turning back, basically, especially in the context of so many lives lost and so many people misplaced inside the country. So most of Ukrainians at the moment still feel incredibly patriotic about their country, very proud. And what's important is that now Ukraine is building a new sense of identity, which is no longer based on ethnic values. It's actually based on values rather than on ethnic identity, clearly linked to just history and language. The important changes that we observe in other regions, for example, Odessa, Kharkiv, and Dnipro, formerly Dnipropetrovsk, they really mark a dramatic shift in how this region's people who live there, how they perceive their Ukrainian identity. But I do hope that further in the discussion we will touch on those issues of identity and memory and the media a little bit more in detail.
Thank you. So as we move forward with our discussion, we're going to try to negotiate both these different ways of looking at the subject. And I think it's a very timely moment to do so, because there is a sense that a certain cycle has gone past. We're about to have a new presidential election in Ukraine next year. A lot of people are trying to make sense of the Maidan, both in historical context, but also because some time has passed to be able to see it as an event in itself. Also, there's the added irony that, which you kind of invoked, that at the time, the Maidan was all about striving for a platonic ideal of Europe. Since then, rise of let's call them populist authoritarians just for the sake of being vague. In Central Europe, Italy is now controlled by a government which, when I visited Italy a year ago, people laughed at the idea that this could ever happen. And as you seem to mention a couple of times in your little talk, America is now a place where you see a kleptocratic, proizvol-like government. I don't know if it's in full control or not, but certainly there's very sort of interesting echoes of the sort of regime that Ukrainians rose up against. And then the whole thing is sealed with the career of the wonderful Mr. Manafort, who was, of course, one of the spin doctors who worked with Yanukovych and then went and worked with Donald Trump. So it's not just a sort of an abstract idea. It's actually like people, funds, money laundering, and very, very specific connections. So it all makes this theme very kind of contemporary again after several years after the revolution. But I'm going to ask actually a slightly greedy question first, which might lead into other ones. So I'm working on a book at the moment, and something that comes up again and again and again is an old question that was asked in the 60s and 70s a lot. Why do some people end up rising up or risking their lives for, let's call it, human dignity, and others don't? So I've been talking to Syrians a lot. Both people saw the same thing. Two people have a problem with Assad's regime. Two people are appalled by people getting beaten up by Assad's police. One decides to then go for it and join the revolution. The other one says, no, I won't. Of course, this is Czesław Milosz's big question in The Captive Mind, but it's one that I've never been able to answer. And there seems to be two answers that I hear. I'd love to know your opinion and how it relates to this and all your research. One seems to think there's an a priori mentality that people have, some sort of inborn open-mindedness, whatever. And others are more closed-minded and don't want that. I mean, that's reflected in some sort of like psychological theories. So that seems to be one approach. The other one really sees it just as a series almost of accidental events, that one person, due to something that happened at school, something they saw, gets driven in one way, another in another way. What's your sense? Did you come up with any kind of answer to this question? Because I haven't, actually. And I ask people, and they just no one can give me a clear answer.
Well, this is another thing about historians, that unlike social scientists who work in a laboratory, you can't do a control study on real life. So historians can never know for certain what causes what, because you can't go back and run the scene again and hold certain variables constant in the interest of determining what's causal and what's confounding. Now, I ask myself the same question. My intuition is that there's a role of individual personality and will, but there's a huge role of contingency. I mean, when Milosz writes in The Captive Mind, what Americans don't understand is that the habit of civilization is fragile. A sudden change in circumstances and it all falls apart. And this is what I think now Americans didn't understand. You know, I mean, I felt like, you know, even among my colleagues leading up to the election, there was it can't happen, not here. I mean, we're Americans, I mean, maybe somewhere else, but, you know, we have the very best democratic institutions, we drink our liberalism with our mother's milk, like, you know, we have checks and balances. And then in like the paralysis and numbness after the November 2016 elections, I felt like my colleagues were going around the university saying, checks and balances, like a yoga mantra, you know, like, no, we're Americans, you know, it could really fall apart somewhere else, but we're Americans. And as a historian, I'm like, oh no, you don't understand. Things can look normal, but they could turn on a dime. You know, and people you didn't expect to turn could turn. So I think there is a radical combination, you know, of contingency of events, you know, plus some combination of individual personality variables. And I think the personality variables are also dependent on events. And one thing that's totally moved me, you know, even though it's disappointing from the point of view of the young generation, is the nationalist populist government in Poland, you know, comes to power unexpectedly. You know, and my friends in Poland who really taught me about Poland, who were kind of my, you know, mentors in some sense, who are a generation older, who went through Solidarity, who sat in prison, literally the same people who were leading the demonstrations in March 1968, the students who got beaten up in March 1968 in Poland, who got beaten up then, who sat in prison then, half a century has passed, they are grandparents, and they were the first ones back out on the street. And I thought, like, wow, you can't break those guys. I mean, they can be wrong, they can misjudge a situation, they can make a mistake, they can pick the wrong strategy, but they have seen it all, and they're not going to sell out now. You know? And that was incredibly moving. Now, the sad thing was that they were pulling their kids and grandparents and grandchildren on the street. You know, it was not the students who were running out to the street. You know, it was the grandparents. But there has been a kind of like watching those people who were imprisoned 50 years ago and now are grandparents be back out on the streets again has given me some kind of, you know, faith that there is something like human integrity. But those were, in fact, the same people who were totally captivated by the Maidan. And I think, and when I say that so much of my understanding of the Maidan in some ways went through Polish eyes, you know, it was for those people who went through solidarity, who saw those moments where suddenly the parents and the children and the workers and the intellectuals and the Marxists and the Catholics and the Jews and the Christians and all of these hitherto existing divisions were overcome. They know better than anybody else that that moment is fragile, it's precarious, it's ephemeral, it has never ever lasted. But they also knew that it was the miracle that most people never lived to see, and that they never expected to see a second time in their lifetimes. And they couldn't turn away. And when I saw some of those people in Kiev, you know, in spring of 2014, people I've known for years, for decades, who, you know, I mean, I like to think they're always happy to see me, but I see them in Kiev and they're ecstatic. I mean, Kostek Gebert, like, picked me up and twirled me around. I mean, as I said, I've known him for 20-some years. I like to think he's always happy to see me. But there was a sense of, this is the thing we didn't think we'd live to see again. You know, and we know, where it's not that they're optimist. They know better than anybody else how quickly it falls apart. That kind of solidarity, that lasted 20 seconds after communism fell. And they have spent the past quarter century, you know, having experienced it fall apart. But they also appreciated the revelation of that human potential to display integrity, you know, and to stake your life on values and to find those moments of solidarity. So those questions when you're thinking, like, why is the human subject so fragile and why does civilization fall apart so quickly and, like, how do we ever determine who's going to make one choice and who's going to make another choice? I try to hold on. I try to hold on to these examples and think, like, there has to be something. There has to be something that people have the capacity for and people have demonstrated that make you think, like, it's worth having children and not jumping off a bridge.
What do you think, Marina? Why does some people go out and join and go through this transformative experience and why others do not?
I was actually thinking about this defining moment on the 30th of November when the students strike, when the students got beaten up and they were joined by their parents that you so eloquently described. Why, in fact, they were joined by thousands of people in the Maidan Square just a few days after. And it seems to me that it also has to do with a lot with the fact, the kind of regime that Ukraine had in the face of Yanukovych. That one has to keep in mind that Yanukovych is very different from Putin, for example, that many Ukrainians saw him as an insult to decency and common sense, quite simply. You know, because Putin, he's an intelligent operative, so to say. Mm. Yanukovych was anything but. Mm. So just, you know, that fact that Ukraine was about to sign the association agreement was that little, you know, hook that Ukrainians were clinging to, hoping that that would kind of keep him a little bit, you know, keep the whole country a little bit closer to Europe and Yanukovych maybe a little bit more in check. And then when that came through, fell through, and it was very obvious that it was Russian support, because that was the time when Russians also issued a bond to Ukrainians of $3 billion that now Ukrainians successfully contested in court. I think that was the moment when the parents decided to join the children, because it was just too much for them to take. Not even, you know, the amount of repression that was present in the Ukrainian society, which at that point was not critical. It became critical in January with the adoption of those laws and when the first deaths happened on Maidan. But I think that that was the moment, really.
Well, part of the reason I raised this mentality question was that, and you actually cover this in your book, because the book isn't just about the Maidan. The book then goes and looks at the war and the conflicts in Ukraine afterwards. And it was a while ago since I read it, so I'm sorry if I misquote, but it's certainly something that I've seen a lot when I've travelled in eastern Ukraine. You have a lot of people who went through the Maidan and see then the resistance to it in various parts of the east of the country. The resistance to the idea that it was that it was actually a positive social transformation. And there is the growth of a sort of a discourse which says, oh, those people there who don't get the Maidan, they have the wrong mentality. And I never really quite understood what that meant. And that's become a bit of a trope, not necessarily a top-down trope, often a bottom-up sort of understanding of how to appreciate what's going on in the country. And I wonder where do you think that comes from? What's the consequences of that? And what exactly do people mean by it? Because I have very conflicting thoughts about that. Maybe Marina first, because I know you've been thinking about this.
Well, that probably boils down to the question that inside Ukraine, even before Maidan, we had several conflicting identities. Long has been said about divisions between East and West, or between Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers, but obviously the difference is much more subtle than that. But the fundamental difference was between those looking towards the past and those towards the future. People in the east of Ukraine, with its connection to its nostalgia for Soviet past, for the relative stability and comfort that Soviet authorities were able to provide, all this was nurtured by Russian media, and in the east traditionally, Russian consumption of Russian media always dominated. So it resulted in this very complex, all these elements, they grew together in a particular type of identity, which created a very fertile ground for this conflict. And then when the Russian propaganda machine started bringing into motion this whole narrative about Maidan as being a coup, fascist coup, supported by the West, etc., it all generated in the East, lots of protest, and it was kind of predictable. I think this is eventually it boils down to an issue of different narratives, which are very difficult to break. It takes years to break, and that's what actually Ukraine is now trying to do with building its own narrative.
Maybe I'll just add for some American perspective on this that. Yeah, one thing, like especially my friends from Western Ukraine and from Lviv, kept saying is that they're all like it's Homo Sovieticus, like these people who voted for Yanukovych, in the East, who think we're fascist in the West. That, and I kept looking at Yanukovych, thinking that, it's not just that he's a gangster; it's that he's kind of nakedly, unapologetically a gangster. He's not even a charismatic gangster. I mean, he's not, as you say, he's not clever like Putin. He's not spinning some great narrative of transcendence, of some kind of higher purpose for higher suffering. No, he's just a gangster. So what kind of person votes for a gangster? And they're like, oh, these people are backwards. They have the Soviet mentality. Well, Yanukovych flees the country. His PR, specialist for gangsters with presidential ambitions is then out of a job. We know what he does next. And it turns out that Americans are no better, than whoever in the Donbass was voting for Yanukovych, because, Paul Manafort, the specialist for gangsters with, presidential ambitions, then comes back, and does the same thing in the United States, and Americans go for it. So this, causes me to think, well, like, is there really something so special about, about a kind of mentality in the Donbass? Because it turns out that Americans fell for basically exactly the same stuff, that Trump is not nearly as charismatic or as clever as Putin. He's, his narrative of transcendence is pathetic, and he's obviously just a kind of, very thin veil for his own pathological narcissism, but Americans bought it too. In fact, when I was, maybe I'll tell one short story and then I'll stop babbling again, but I, as a neurotic catastrophist, I was afraid that, you know, yeah. As a neurotic catastrophist, I was terrified, you know, that as the elections were coming up. But even I didn't think in November 2016 it was going to come to that. You know, there was a lot of tension. You know, I my son, who was in first grade, I kept him out of school in the morning so he could vote for me, which, because Americans are incompetent at having elections, meant standing in line for hours and hours, which is why he missed the morning in school. You know, because he said, "Mommy, you know, if Hillary Clinton wins, then all the grown-ups are going to calm down, right?" You know, and I said, "Yes, it's all going to be okay. There's going to be some closure." You know, I was reassuring him. And then, like, you know, the next morning, you know, I took my kids to school. I was lying on the floor of my office at Yale, throwing up into a plastic bag. And the first person who called me was Slava Varkarchuk, calling from Kiev, the Ukrainian rock star. And he's like, "Marcy, it's Slava, and I'm calling to give you my moral support. And I think I know how you feel. This is kind of how I felt in 2010 when I realized that we actually voted for Yanukovych. You know, that we did this, that our society did this, and maybe this is something societies have to go through and learn from their mistakes." You know? And finally he's like, "Marcy, you have a wonderful husband and two beautiful children. Please get up off the floor." But I think there was something to that empathy. You know, like, Ukrainians voted for Yanukovych in 2010. Americans voted for Trump in 2016. So, you know, we didn't have a Soviet experience. You know, are we also Soviet? Are we also kind of Homo Sovieticus? Are we also all looking backwards? Well, perhaps yes. You know, but I think it causes me to question the exceptionality, you know, of that idea of, oh, well, that backwards mentality in the Donbas, because it seems to spread very quickly to unexpected places.
Let's just make one little remark. I remember when Trump started his presidential campaign, and for the first time on Facebook, I saw the pictures of his apartment in his Trump Tower. And I looked at that and I thought, this looks so much like Yanukovych. And it struck me so much. You know, the only thing missing was like the golden lock. Zolotyy baton, as we call it.
Well,
and then, you know, unsurprisingly, Manafort was campaign manager for both of them.
So maybe it's not a mentality thing in terms of history, nostalgia. Maybe we're actually talking about aesthetics. These are actually we're actually aesthetically preconditioned to certain patterns of voting. Anyway, that's a very good remark about the similarity of Yanukovych's and Trump's tastes. Are we going on until 8:30? I wonder when do we open this up to our wonderful floor? Mm. We're going to 8 or 8:30? 8. So we've got to open this up in the name of democracy. I'll take bunches of questions. Don't be shy. I mean, I can ask them myself, but one over here.
Hi, my name is Lesia, and I'm working with the Ukrainian Institute as well. I just wanted to say, if you felt bad, try being a Ukrainian-American Brit. We have Brexit as well. I've been in a constant state of anxiety since 2016. But what you were saying about the generational thing really struck me, because it seemed to me, in my own thoughts, that, one, we haven't had a world war in a long time, which is that the young people aren't out on the streets. I keep asking my three stepchildren who are at university, why aren't you protesting Brexit more? Because it's all going to affect you. And they're like, well, we kind of do, but, you know, I think they think that things are going to work out. They don't feel that there's an activism, that things can turn on a dime, as you said. And it didn't surprise me what you said about the older generation. But of course, you have the older generation being really nostalgic, so voting for Brexit here. And in America, you've got a variety of people voting for Trump, not just old, but also young people who have fallen for the tail. So I was just wondering whether you thought it was a generational thing, specifically in Ukraine or Eastern Europe, or do you think it rather depends on the history of where the nation is? Because we see this trend internationally, that we've got the rise of nationalism. So you could say collectively that people, that are young people, have forgotten about the large-scale wars, and that it's the old people. But then, of course, you have old people who are also falling for the narrative, if you see what I mean, the false narratives. So I was just wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about the generational aspect.
It's a really interesting question. I don't know that I have a good answer. I mean, I think that the Fukuyama-esque end of history narrative, I think, may have been stronger in some ways in Europe, but the sense that, you know, the Cold War's over, liberal democracy won, you know, maybe the Marxist version of Hegel was right, but there's a liberal version of Hegel, maybe the Marxist version of Hegel was wrong, but there's a liberal version of Hegel, which is that everything is leading inevitably, inexorably towards liberal democracy, you know, and there are some tweaks, but eventually, you know, we're all going to get there. I mean, this speaks also to what Marina is talking about, reforms, like, okay, if it's slower, is it faster? But is there a path, you know, that, well, eventually, sooner or later, some people slower, some people faster, everyone eventually gets there. And that was that, you know, 1989 end of history narrative. You know, and that generation then that grew up, something that my generation, with that narrative of the end of history, there was a certain kind of complacency to it. You know, that a lack of appreciation for the fragility of it all, because you're kind of coming into being, you're coming into awareness at a time when everything seems to be leading there. I mean, I think in America things changed on September 11th to a certain extent, although it's that's a little bit hard to measure. But I think there is I think there is something about. Like my friends in Poland who are my age, you know, who were formed by communism but then made careers after communism, who had children much younger than I did, who have kids who are already at universities, their kids have no memory of communism. And they don't have that, they're not politically engaged as much, and they don't have that sense of the fragility. And I feel like they're not posing also the same kinds of questions, the question Americans never pose, of the difference between democracy and liberalism. Like, Americans assume that's the same thing. They assume that, like, if you let people choose, they're all going to choose liberal values. But that was never the case. You know, all of the things that made liberalism fragile at the turn of the 19th and 20th century still make it fragile today. And people are saying, like, why are those people, like, in the Donbass so stupid and so zombie-like, you know, and so, you know, so vulnerable to Russian propaganda that they actually think there was a CIA fascist coup, sponsored fascist coup in Kiev, and that there are people coming to the Donbass to kill all the Russian speakers. What kind of backwards idiots would believe that? And I understand the frustration with people believing that. But I'm now coming from a place where I'm trying to, you know, explain to, like, my six-year-old that, well, some people voted for Trump because they actually believe that Hillary Clinton was kidnapping small children and hiding them in a pizza restaurant, you know, in Washington. And, like, is that any better? Are we any superior? Are we any more sophisticated? And our history played itself out very differently. So, yeah, no, the generational question is interesting. I think the generations are much more mixed. In the States, I mean, there seems to have been people across the board voting for Trump, although it's actually where, you know, we live in such a bubble that I don't know any of them personally, you know, so in some sense I feel just as distant from my understanding of the Americans who voted for Trump, I feel, is not really any better than my understanding of the people in the Donbass who voted for Yanukovych.
I know lots of both, but... many of them in my family.
Paulina, I'm here a researcher at UCL, and maybe a digression rather than a question when you said about generational change. So I've been away, I'm from Poland, and I've been away from the country for the last 5 years. And I came back, I see some of my friends from high school, you know, so they are now working in financial sector, they're traveling. This is not a case you'd say a person that is not open to European Union. And when I ask, what do you think about the recent change of government? Like, what is your approach to this? And a friend of mine just said, it'd be easier, believe me, it's so much easier to rule a country when there's just one man in charge. I just sat down. I was like, this is incredible. So when you say that young people are not going on the streets, it's maybe not because only they're not aware of what it's been like, but it's also because some of them really believe that it would be better, which I was really, really distressed. So. Maidan and Ukraine and the case, the solidarity that you're fighting for and fighting with, it's something that Poland maybe should be reminded of, really.
And what are their aesthetic choices?
We learn so much into gold, we have to carry it to
Was that a question, or that was more a digression? But I think we'll include it in our conversation, because again, it's the question that haunts me. Why are some people have a predilection towards this, or is it something that happened in their childhood? What is it that puts people who seem to have a similar demographic background into completely different camps around these issues?
Got a question that doesn't tie in particularly with your comment that you just made, but one of the things that's striking me is that we haven't spoken about the Orange Revolution at all. It's as if it didn't happen. And as I was in Kiev during the Orange Revolution, and then when 2014 happened, and so much of that reminded me of exactly what had gone on in 2004, and yet it's as if, I mean, for some of the people in 2014, it was like we've already done this once, and then we lost it, and we can't afford to let it go again, and we must get out there. I don't know if I'm right, because it wasn't there, but I would love to hear some comments about where does the Orange Revolution fit in, please.
Maybe I should try.
Yeah.
I was just keen to take more questions in a bundle. There's one over there. Actually, there's a lot about that phenomenon in Martin's book, but we'll come back to that in a second.
Thanks for your wonderful talk and discussion. I find it hard to formulate my question because I have so many in my head, but I'll try and stick to one sort of line and be brief. You present a very specific picture of Maidan, and it's hard to disagree with what you say, of course, but Maidan was many things. I researched gender on Maidan, and I found a lot of sexism, for instance, and a lot of sort of very interesting gender dynamics, and not just gender dynamics, but hierarchical dynamics. Of course, there was sort of solidarity, people working together, but there was also a lot that people had to put to the side in order to preserve that solidarity. And that's, I think, we're seeing the outcome of that now as well in some of the discussions that are taking place. But the question I wanted to say is about the outcome, essentially. A lot of those people who were so keen, young people who were the forefront of the Maidan, and people didn't go to the Maidan to die. They went to change their lives for better, right? They died, unfortunately, not because they were ready to die, as it were, right? So that's a sort of romantic vision that I find difficult to share, because, you know, they didn't go to die, as it were. They went to live. But a lot of those who were very active on the Maidan then joined volunteer battalions, joined the army, and went east. And some of them are dead because of that, and quite a lot, because the first wave suffered huge losses, or several waves. But some of them are veterans, some of them are still there, and there's a huge sense of disappointment. We've got an oligarch in power, maybe a different type of oligarch, but still maybe he doesn't have a golden loaf. Don't know about his aesthetic choices, but still an oligarch. There's all sorts of problems, and there's a huge sense of disappointment, especially among those people who were in the epicenter of the Maidan, and then really, literally at the front line in eastern Ukraine. And more or less since the end of the Maidan, people talked about the next Maidan or the possibility of it. And they said that this is not going to be about peace. There were deaths on the Maidan, but the remarkable thing about it, for 3 months there was peace, right? It was a peaceful protest. But when people mentioned the next potential Maidan, they say that's about bloodshed. It's about something much more radical than that. So I find it hard to formulate the question, but really my question is about the outcome, disappointment, and the potential of the next revolution, which might be very different.
So, Orange, so kind of two very connected questions. Orange Revolution, disappointment, Maidan, disappointment, next Maidan. Is that the logic that we're in?
Maybe I will start with Orange Revolution, because I actually covered Orange Revolution as a BBC reporter, and I went there and I witnessed everything firsthand. I think, obviously, it's very different from Maidan. It was very much like carnival-like. It was very much like Maidan in the first month before the dictatorship laws. Why it didn't take a dramatic turn, I think because luckily, as far as I remember, the timeline of events, because the Supreme Court then decided that a second vote has to take place, and then Yushchenko won. So kind of this tension was taken off, and there was no need to go in the, you know, protest anymore. But certainly the social capital of Maidan was a, you know, huge help for mobilization of Ukrainian society 9 years down the line. As far as this logic that was in the last question, what's going to happen, is the next Maidan is coming? I think there are lots of people who were on Maidan. They actually became reformers in the new government. I could even name some of them. And I think many of them came to realize that the change has to be incremental. On the other hand, as the war is still raging, there's a growing number of people who are very radical. There's also more weapon readily available to take, you know, to protest against what they still see as a very unjust system. So certainly it's a factor which remains and which probably will be growing, especially if in the next presidential elections a more populist inclined candidate is going to win, and then reforms probably are likely to slow down even more. So I can see a sense in that progression that we had very peaceful carnival-like Orange Revolution, that we had Maidan with, you know, 100 people dying, and so does it mean we're going to have third Maidan, which is going to be incredibly bloody? I hope not.
I hope not, too. I historians are terrible about predicting what will happen, so I won't make any prediction. I'll say that I was struck by how, I mean, this is a book about other people. You know, to some extent, it's a kind of book about my friends and colleagues and the friends and colleagues of my friends and colleagues. And I was struck by the consistency with which very different people described the fatal mistake of the Orange Revolution. You know, that we went out on the streets then and we thought if you replace the bad guy with the good guy, it was all going to be okay. You know, and the betrayal of Yushchenko, his disappointment, was a cure for our paternalism. This time we know that there's no Messiah. You know, there's going to be no waiting. No one's going to lead us into the promised land. There's not going to be any kind of great leader, you know, who takes us there. We have to do it ourselves, and we have to do it from the bottom up. And I think that understanding was widespread. There was, maybe I'll tell one more story about Slava. Varkarchuk, because Slava came to Yale, I should explain, after, he came to talk to students at Yale right after the Maidan, but then he came for a whole semester the following year, basically to study political transformation. He was the most enthusiastic student at Yale. He started off the semester auditing 23 classes. He wanted to understand Athenian democracy. You know, he wanted to understand it from the beginning, you know, all the way up. And he was really trying to think through precisely this mistake, the mistake of paternalism. Like, why were we always waiting for a Messiah? There's no Messiah. You know, nobody else is going to do this. We have to take responsibility. We have to do this ourselves. Well, how do you build up the kind of society that is ready to take responsibility? You know, not just as a civil society, but also as a government. You know, under what circumstances does it work? What circumstances does it not work? And at the end of his time at Yale, and he was so earnest and so intense and spent hours and hours a day at the library reading, you know, and then he gave this talk for the Ukrainian diaspora community in New Haven, you know, and he invited my husband and myself to come. He actually also invited our children. It's probably just as well we didn't take them. It wasn't really a kid-friendly talk. But he had been thinking about all these things so intensely, you know, and he spoke to this audience of all people who adored him, and he said, you know, we have to figure out how to do this ourselves. Nobody is going to come with any magical solutions. There's not going to be any hero. There's not going to be any guy on a white horse. You know, there's not going to be any team of good guys. Well, we have to figure out what we need ourselves. Each of us has to take responsibility and do it ourselves. And he had been thinking about this so hard, and he stopped talking. And then this woman stood up, you know, and said to him in Ukrainian, and there were hundreds of people here, he said, Slava, I love you. We all love you. You know, you are our savior, you know, like be our leader, you know, become our president. And everyone is cheering. And it was just heartbreaking. Like my heart just broke for him because he was so earnest and he had been thinking about this so much. And of course, she was the embodiment of everything he had just so carefully articulated they had to fight against within themselves, but totally unknowingly, you know, totally like without any self-awareness. And like, it was, but he's so good. Like he was very nice and generous and didn't point that out to her, but my heart kind of broke for him. So taking responsibility. But I think that was the revelation, I think, after the Orange Revolution, that, okay, it can't just be about some guy and getting rid of some guy and bringing in a better guy. Let me make just a couple more quick comments in response to the other questions. One of the things about, you know, about America and what's going on in Europe and the generations, Anne Applebaum just wrote this fantastic, very moving piece in The Atlantic, which started, for those of you who haven't read it, started off with this New Year's Eve party that she and her husband, Radek Sikorski, threw at their country house in Poland in 1999, turn of the new millennium. And she talks about how, you know, there were 100 people there, you know, and they were all kind of, you know, center-right or maybe center-left conservatives, and there was this sense of, you know, being on the cusp, you know, of this new, you know, world of liberal democracy and of stability. And while people had different ideas, there was a kind of sense of unity and optimism. And she said now, you know, 20 years later, half of those people are no longer speaking to us. They wouldn't set foot in our house. Half of them are no longer talking to the other half. And those are stories that my friends from Eastern Ukraine have very much told me since the war started in the Donbass, that like I've lost, you know, my friends in Kharkiv split up, you know, my friends in Luhansk split up, you know, the family split up. That I haven't seen in the States as much. But maybe I haven't been in the right circles. Like I've seen the country has split up, but the people who were previously on the same side, there is nobody that I know, even among people who were, you know, way more conservative than I am, who actually voted for Trump. Which doesn't mean most people didn't, but it seems to be running less through milieu that had previously been intact. I haven't seen people losing friends the same way, more of previously existing communities becoming entrenched. The other thing I really want to bring up, and especially because Peter is here and because Marina has been thinking along the Donbass, is that, you know, for me the Maidan was this, in some sense, this kind of pre or maybe post-postmodern moment. You know, it was this return to a philosophy of the 70s and 80s that opposed communism, that said, no, there is such a thing as truth. And there is such a thing as the self, and there is such a thing as values, and there is such a thing as taking responsibility. And it's not just all a PR game, and it's not all a language game, and it's not all that is solid melts into air. They're all real values, and there are things that are worth staking your life on, you know, and that we are going to go out there because we believe that there is such a thing as truth, and there is such a thing as the self. And what has come up, you know, in the Donbass is really what Peter writes about, much more than what I write about, but is this kind of explosion of what is post-truth. You know, when Marx wrote All That Is Solid Melts Into Air, it was 1848, but he was precocious. All that was solid was not yet melting. It's only with postmodernism that all the solids melt. Because now there really is this sense of like, well, who knows? Maybe this, maybe that. Like, I turned on early in the war in the Donbass, RT, the English edition, to see how they were. Marina's going to cringe when I tell this story. I mean, it's not, you know, to see how they were kind of reporting, you know, on the war in the Donbass, you know, and of course there was, you know, widespread understanding among people following that, you know, of course there were, you know, there were Russian soldiers in the Donbass. But officially there were no Russian soldiers in the Donbass. You know, and in this RT episode, so you have this American guy who looked like, I don't know, he was maybe 25 or just out of college and really wanted to be on TV. I'm sure Peter's met some of these guys, who spoke a tiny bit of Russian, like maybe as much as you learn from an internet program on the flight over, you know, and he seemed to be in the Donbass, although who knows where he really was, but ostensibly he was in the Donbass. And he's like, okay, today our show is going to be about Russian soldiers in the Donbass because we keep hearing that there are Russian soldiers in the Donbass, and I thought I'd come and see if there are any here. So let's go try to find out. Oh, look, there are some guys in camouflage. Let's go mosey over to them. Привет, привет, привет. Ви русский? And they're like, I don't know. These guys don't seem to be Russian. But maybe there are some somewhere else. Let's keep looking. Let's like walk down the street. Oh, look, there are some more guys wearing green. Maybe those are the Russians. Let's go over to them. Ви русский? Ви. I don't know. I don't see any. I don't. We could keep looking. I mean, we could look all day. Maybe there's some. But it was absurdist, but it wasn't even like trying not to be absurdist. You know, at the end, and it wasn't even like maybe there are, maybe there aren't, who knows? I mean, this is what Peter like captures in this book. Maybe nobody can know, so there's no point trying to figure it out. You know, and I think that difference, you know, that line between, you know, the modern and the postmodern, I think you could almost feel that line being crossed tangibly late February, March 2014.
So in that sense, are we actually positioning this question about future and the past, about nostalgia, completely the wrong way around? Are actually the protesters on Maidan the nostalgic ones, while the ones who are living in a kind of a present without a future, which is what postmodernism is, whether in America or Poland or Donbass, actually, you know, more of what we're getting. I don't want to say the word the future because they don't have a conception of the future by definition, but is actually the other way around. Is this like the last nostalgic act trying to sort of like crawl back the values of the 70s and you know these wonderful conversations that I grew up with because my parents were part of that generation. And that was just it. This is the end. This was the nostalgic act.
No, in some sense, I think you're right. You know, because for me, you know, modernism, or this is how I pitch it to my undergraduates, God died, and you try to replace God. You try to find something else that will still give you a real self, real truth, real responsibility, real moral values. You try to find some way to ground it. You insist that it can be done. That even if God is dead, we still are, you know, human beings endowed with moral reason who can stake ourselves on a notion of truth and a notion of values. And right, and now that seems kind of quaint and old-fashioned and nostalgic. When Zhubov, the one who wrote the piece about the annexation of Crimea, comparing it to the Sudetenland. What's his first name? Anyway, there's a Russian kind of dissident historian who, in March 2014, Zhubov, wrote a piece that gets him fired for his job, comparing the Russian annexation of Crimea to the German annexation of the Sudetenland in 1938, which is, from a historian's point of view, it was an irresistible comparison. He gets thrown out of his job, and I then saw him give a lecture in Olomouc in the Czech Republic. You know, and at one point, in Russian, he was saying, «Мы должны говорить правду». You know, we should speak the truth. You know, it's a historian's job to speak the truth. You know, and that sounded nostalgic. That sounded quaint. It sounded old-fashioned. But you listened and you thought, like, yes, you know, we need to somehow get that moment back where you believe there is such a thing as truth and it means something to say it.
Well, then maybe what we're actually talking about is not past and future anymore, but different types of nostalgia. I mean, Svetlana Boym, the great Harvard scholar, talks about two types of nostalgia, which I think you do see play out in Ukraine. So restorative nostalgia and reflective nostalgia. Reflective nostalgia is understanding the past, coming to terms with it, taking what's good and bad out of it. Restorative tries to restore it, and in her famous phrase, restorative nostalgia breeds monsters, which I thought about a lot when I wasn't allowed into DNR, but when I talked to people who were in DNR, that's the Donetsk National Republic, which seemed by their stories to be the idea of an attempt to recreate a sort of Soviet Dismaland, a sort of bizarre farce, dark farce of the Soviet Union. And there are so many parallels of that, what Kaczynski's doing, what Orban's doing, with what, I was going to say Trump, but Rees-Mogg? I mean, what the hell is that?